This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. A CIA veteran expects Al-Qaeda to rebuild within Afghanistan. We get details from AP correspondent Mike Gracia.
Michael Morrell, who was the CIA analyst who briefed President George W. Bush on September 11, 2001, said Tuesday he's convinced the Taliban will invite Al-Qaeda to rebuild in Afghanistan. Morrell, who twice served as acting CIA director, spoke at an online forum sponsored by the U.S. Attorney's Office for the Eastern District of Virginia. It was one of a series of panels this week to commemorate the 20th anniversary of the September 11 attacks. Morrell twice served as acting CIA director, and he briefed President Barack Obama on the intelligence that led to the killing of Osama bin Laden. He said there's no doubt in his mind the Taliban will give safe haven to Al-Qaeda, and he believes Al-Qaeda's intention will be to build capability so they can attack us here at home. Mike Gracia, Washington.
Meanwhile, the Taliban announced an interim government that seems unlikely to win the international support the new leaders desperately need to avoid an economic meltdown. AP's Ben Thomas has details.
It's an all-male interim government taking charge in Afghanistan, and it's stacked with veterans of their hardline rule from the 1990s in the 20-year battle against the U.S.-led coalition and its Afghan government allies. Among the most notable names, Sirajuddin Haqqani as interior minister. He heads the feared Haqqani network that's blamed for many deadly attacks and kidnappings. And he's on the FBI's most wanted list with a $5 million bounty on his head. The Haqqani network is believed to still be holding at least one American hostage. I'm Ben Thomas.
And again, the Taliban announcing an interim government that seems unlikely to win the international support that the new leaders need. This is VOA News. The Americans trying to evacuate hundreds of Afghans and American citizens, including one Afghan who worked as a U.S. military translator and says he's anticipating his beheading by the Taliban, pleaded for action from the Biden administration to get the would-be evacuees aboard charter flights that are standing by to fly them from Afghanistan. The man whose identity the Associated Press withheld for his security said he was running out of money to keep his family housed in a hotel in a northern Afghan city after waiting a week for Taliban permission for the chartered evacuation flights to leave the airport there. The UN Atomic Watchdog says Iran has continued to increase its stockpile of highly enriched uranium that could be used to make nuclear weapons in contravention of a 2015 accord with world powers that was meant to contain Tehran's nuclear program. The International Atomic Energy Agency also told member states in its confidential quarterly report Tuesday that its verification and monitoring activities have been seriously undermined since February by Iran's refusal to let inspectors access IAEA monitoring equipment. The IAEA's director general said that he was willing to travel to Iran to meet the recently elected government for talks on the topic. Two cameras that the agency installed at one site in Iran have been severely damaged. COVID-19 booster shots may be coming for at least some Americans, but there's still important science to be worked out about who really needs them and when. The Biden administration's initial plan was to offer the Pfizer or Moderna booster starting September 20th, while real-world data shows the vaccines used in the U.S. remain strongly protective against severe disease and death. Their ability to prevent milder infection is dropping for reasons that are not fully understood. Scientific advisors will publicly debate Pfizer's evidence on September 17th. Tens of thousands of supporters of Brazil's embattled right-wing president, Jair Bolsonaro, heeded his call and turned down on Independence Day rallies as he stepped up his attacks on the Supreme Court and threatened to plunge the country into a constitutional crisis. Bolsonaro has been locked in a feud with the court, in particular a justice who has jailed several of the president's supporters for allegedly financing, organizing, or inciting violence or anti-democratic acts, or disseminating false information. In calling on his followers to take to the streets, Bolsonaro had stirred fear that the demonstrations could erupt in violence akin to the January 6th riot at the U.S. Capitol. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Music. morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 8th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Guinea's main opposition leader comments on participating in the transition on government.
My part with the winning to send people to work there, it only is to help implementing a solid, reliable, and democratic institution.
Liberians decry the shortage of rice, the country's staple food. Millions face hunger crisis as conflict engulfs northern Ethiopia. A judge in Eswatini has again postponed a bill hearing for two jailed members of parliament. We will have analysis of this week's alliance of Gambia's ruling party and the party of former president Yahya Jammeh. And a magistrate court charges two Ugandan opposition members of parliament with murder.
You remember that in Arua, they got guns and ammunition and planted them in Bobi Wine's hotel room. But all of that eventually failed. You know, so like everything else, all these trumped up charges will fall. We are not worried about them at all.
And COVID-19 pandemic fuels school dropouts in South Africa. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. In Guinea, the leader of the main opposition party, Union of Democratic Forces of Guinea, the UFDG, says the September 5 coup was justified because President Alpha Condé was an illegitimate president who changed the constitution to run for a third term. Speaking to VOA through an interpreter, Selu Dalin Diallo says all the ills of the Guinean society cited by the military junta had been identified and denounced by his party. Asked if he would personally participate in a united government, if the military were to ask him to do so, Diallo says he would personally not join a transitional government, but would designate members of his party to take part.
Oui, écoutez, d'abord, il convient de rappeler que Michel Fakonde exerçait un mandat présidentiel illégal.
First of all, I would like to recall that Alpha Condé was exercising an illegitimate and illegal presidential term.
Parce que vous savez, la constitution sur la base de laquelle il a été élu et sur laquelle il a prêté serment interdisait à tout Guinéen d'exercer plus de deux mandats présidentiels consécutifs ou non.
The constitution on the basis of what he was elected forbidden the possibility to run for more than two presidential terms.
Changer cette constitution juste pour se créer le droit de briguer un troisième mandat, mais ce n'était pas légal.
He changed the constitution only to grant himself a third presidential term, but it was not legal.
Donc, pour accéder à ce troisième mandat, il a violé son serment, il a violé la Constitution, il a réprimé dans le sang toutes les manifestations.
To grant himself this illegal third term, he violated the Constitution, he violated his oath, and he organized a bloody repression for all the Guineans who were opposed to this new term.
Oui, je conclue le raisonnement de la première question. Donc, les sangs ont plutôt été soulagés par le coup d'État qui a renversé la dictature. Il s'agissait d'une véritable victoire.
So let me conclude what I was saying. The people of Guinea is absolutely relieved because the military put an end to a dictatorship.
Si bien que la journée du lundi, tout le monde est allé au travail, il n'y a pas une manifestation en dehors des manifestations de juin.
People of Guinea were so satisfied that after the coup on Monday, everybody goes to work, you know, back to normal life.
Mr. Diallo, will you be willing to serve in any unity government if the military were to ask you to? Because the military says it wants to establish a unity government.
Oui, je peux envoyer mon parti et mon alliance se sont disposés à envoyer des réponses.
My party and I and my alliance with the willing to send people to work there, it only is to help implementing a solid, reliable and democratic institutions in the framework of fair, free and inclusive elections.
Let me ask again, will you personally serve in any unity government if the military were to ask you to serve?
Non, personnellement non, je vais être président de la République. J'ai été déjà élu en octobre 2020. S'il y a des élections libres et transparentes, je préfère être plutôt candidat que d'être dans le gouvernement de transition.
No, I'm not going to serve in this transition government. I can designate and send my representative, but personally, no. I won the election of October 2020, And I'm the president, and if there's election, so I run again, contest again.
So a member of the National Front for the Defense of the Constitution, the FNDC, told one of my colleagues earlier this week that the FNDC leaders are not ready to join any future unity government unless a thorough and independent investigation into allegations of corruption and violation of human rights is carried out. What is your view?
Oui, je souhaite vivement que la lutte contre la corruption et la lutte contre l'impunité soient dans les priorités du gouvernement de transition, en plus de l'organisation des élections.
I highly recommend that the fight against corruption and the fight against human rights violations should be between the top priorities of the junta during the implementation of the transition government.
Mr. Diallo, let me say merci beaucoup.
Merci beaucoup. Thank you very much.
All right. Nadia, you did a fantastic job. Merci beaucoup, well, and
thank you very much, Jen.
That was Selu Darlene Diallo, the leader of Guinea's main opposition UFDG party, speaking to us from Conakry with the assistance of his spokesperson, Nadia Nama, as interpreter. Rice dealers in Liberia are complaining about what they say is a scarcity of rice on the local market. But as Rita Jolabwe reports from Monrovia, the Liberian government says business people are creating an artificial shortage of the country's staple food.
It all started about 3 weeks ago when community stores added an additional $3 to a 25-kilogram bag of rice, which was previously sold for $14.50. A week later, residents could no longer find a 25-kilogram bag of rice to purchase because shop owners resorted to selling rice per cup instead. They say this was necessary because they were no longer receiving supplies from wholesalers. Lincoln Toga is one of the prominent rice dealers in Riverses, one of Liberia's 15 counties. Toga says he is worried because he does not have enough rice to meet his customers' needs.
The rice that we brought for the past 1 week, it has gone down low. I contacted my customers that they should send me at least 30 bags. They are saying that even though the price is very high, no source people bought it. So right now, as we speak, our supplier don't have no rice in Manila, so we don't know where to even get rice from now.
This past weekend, a group of rice dealers were seen fighting in long queues at the main entrance of the Freeport of Monrovia. The business people said the hike in the price of rice was the result of the many challenges they face each day to purchase rice.
We say online, will I get better? We get way fast. How can a woman be like this to us? We vote for them and put them in power and they stop it all like this.
The progress too much. We're fighting for the rest. We can move on to our house in the neighbor, 4 o'clock, 5 o'clock, to come say online. And as will be so, you will pay money to go and buy the rest. You pay, right? You pay money for the pot. If the pot won't tell you, say, want to ask you, that pay the want to ask you, you pay in store.
Who is just out there working, no rest, want for the government to come in?
Registration for the next school year is expected to begin soon, but local rice dealers are already expressing fear that they might not be able to enroll their children in school because of the scarcity of rice, which they say is their only source of income.
The business we survive on, we come, we buy, we go, we sell, and not to get it, not eat it. So I will send our children to school, and we spend all the money on process. You see how we get our profit, we send our children to school. We don't get profit, we only be selling for them.
And like the government want us to do a lot of things to feed our family because some of us are the only thing we live.
Thomas Kafia is the human resource manager of the United Commodities Incorporated, one of Liberia's leading rice importers. He says his company has enough rice and is even expecting more.
We do not have shortage. We have rice here. Currently, as I speak to you, we have our vessel out there at the Freeport of Monrovia that brought 18,000 metric tons for us. And so each ton is equivalent to 40 bags, the 25 kg. So if you multiply 18,000 metric tons by 40, you're talking about 720,000 bags that we have here that include the pink bag, the R64, and the fatu rice.
The Liberian government has denied that there is a shortage of rice in the country. Commerce Minister Marwen Dix says the ministry will deploy inspectors in the field to regulate the price of rice and other major commodities.
There is no need for panic buying, as we have observed. The wholesale price of rice remains at 13 United States dollars, and there is a sufficient stock of rice in the country. Reports reaching the Ministry of Commerce and Industry suggest that individual businesses are selling at exorbitant prices and in some cases hoarding this commodity, thus creating an artificial scarcity on the market.
Rice is Liberia's staple food, but the country imports most of the commodity. The shortage is happening at a time when the country's struggling economy is being impacted by the coronavirus pandemic. Rita Jrabwe for VOA News, Monrovia, Liberia.
In Uganda, an opposition member of parliament for the party of Robert Kyagulanyi, widely known as Bobi Wine, says the party is busy trying to do the work for which its members were elected, while President Yoweri Museveni, having run out of ideas, is busy coming up with trumped-up criminal charges against members of Wine's National Unity Party. Joel Senyonyi says President Museveni sees Bobi Wine as the only threat to his administration and is therefore making up allegations, just as Museveni did with Dr. Chisa Besigye on several occasions. This comes after a magistrate court Tuesday charged two members of parliament from Bobi Wine's party with murder and attempted murder for their roles in the recent wave of killings of close to 30 people in Uganda's Masaka sub-region. Senyonyi says the party is now worried because such charges will turn out to be false.
Like you're saying, it won't be the first time, really, that Mr. Museveni's government, you know, trumps up charges against his opponents. So did that Dr. Kizza Besigye, the rape case, if you remember, the PDRA rebel outfit, which really was the formulation of the state, and then they accused Besigye's team. And you know, Museveni, at his age, doesn't have any new tricks, any new ideas. So the same old tricks are the ones that he pulls out. But sadly for him, we have mastered his way of doing things. So that's why the entire population is aware that these are trumped up charges and they're not falling for this case.
But these are murder charges.
Yeah, but like I've given examples of Dr. Kizza Besigye, who for a long time was in some 70s calendar. He had terrorism charges against him, rape charges, and so on. They said he had formed a rebel outfit, terrorism, it's a capital offense, and so on and so forth. You remember that in Arua, they got guns and rounds of ammunition and planted them in Bobi Wine's hotel room. But all of that eventually failed. You know, so like everything else, all these trumped up charges will fall. We are not worried about them at all.
The prosecution says the MPs had planned a meeting prior to the alleged murder. Did you have a chance to speak with them or their lawyers in terms of what they intend to plead in court?
So our leaders are following up, our lawyers are following up these particular cases, but our colleagues are very strong because they know that these are fabricated cases. You know, Museveni needs to fabricate and trump up charges against Dr. Kizza Besigye, who has been challenged against. Now, his main challenger is Bobi Wine. So he will target Bobi Wine and all of us, his party members and party leaders. So it's not new. It is the same old tricks of Museveni. But our leaders are very strong. They know that these fake, hopeless charges will eventually fall as well.
The security minister, Major General Jim Muwezi, was quoted in the press as saying that the alleged masterminds should be charged with terrorism. What do you say to his assertion?
We actually want the state to stop trying to cover up and find excuses. They didn't find the real murderers, you know, but getting the position from me and Kampala, no connection whatsoever. You know, one of those particular people, the leaders who arrested was away for the Olympics Games, very much into sports. The other, Sabina, was away, you know, in Netherlands and elsewhere. All these things will happen. So these guys should stop covering up. They should find the real killers. If they don't, then we won't suspect it is the state doing so because it won't be the first time anyway that they kill people.
So let me ask you, how is the party doing, you know, having won many seats in parliament in the last election? How are you doing in parliament?
Well, we are glad that our parliamentarians, our parliamentary front, of which I am part, we are doing everything we can to see, to eat, that we keep fortifying the party. This kind of thing, actually, we are involved in doing the work that is meant to be done by the government, you know. We are building hospitals, we are buying medicine for hospitals, schools, and so on, all which things are supposed to be done by the government. But when you have a dysfunctional government, an absentee government, then, you know, the local leaders get to do all these different things. So we are glad that our leaders are involved in all this work.
Joel Senyanyi is a member of parliament for Bobi Wine's National Unity Party. He was speaking with us from Kampala. You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Wednesday, September 8th. The World Health Organization says emergency food needs in northern Ethiopia are increasing as conflict spills beyond the embattled Tigray region into neighboring Afar and Amhara provinces. Lisa Schlein reports for VOA from Geneva.
The agency reports that up to 7 million people are acutely short of food and are facing a hunger crisis. They include more than 5.2 million people in Tigray who are dependent on UN food aid for survival. Additionally, the World Food Program reports the conflict, which has now engulfed the entire region, has thrust 1.7 million more people into hunger. This month, WFP has begun delivering emergency food assistance to communities in Ethiopia's northern region and says it plans to reach 530,000 people in Afar and 250,000 in Amhara with food aid. Meanwhile, in Tigray, WFP spokesman Thompson Fieri says the situation continues to deteriorate. He says aid agencies are struggling to meet the urgent food needs of more than 5 million people across the war-torn region.
In fact, WFP food stocks had been almost entirely depleted until 2 days ago when the first convoy in over 2 weeks entered the region. The WFP-led convoy of over 100 trucks carried 3,500 metric tons of food and other life-saving cargo, including fuel, as well as health and shelter items.
Fieri says WFP has only managed to get 355 trucks into the region since mid-July. While this sounds like much, he says it is not. He says 355 trucks represents less than 10% of the supplies needed. He says 100 trucks must enter Tigray every day to meet people's food requirements. He says trucks get stuck in Afar because of bureaucratic delays and difficulties in passing checkpoints. He says some trucks also have been attacked and looted by people in local communities.
Aside from the escalating fighting that is in the north of the country, food security for millions across the whole of Ethiopia is also under threat due to an unprecedented funding gap for WFP activities in the country.
WFP is calling for $426 million to expand its emergency food operations to meet the needs of up to 12 million people throughout Ethiopia this year. The agency warns it will be forced to cut rations for people in northern Ethiopia if it does not receive the extra funding. It says it might have to stop distributing food to about 4 million people in Tigray, Afar, and Amhara in the coming months if it runs out of money. November 4th will mark a year since the Ethiopian government began its military offensive to wrest control of the Tigray region from the Tigray People's Liberation Front. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
In Eswatini, formerly Swaziland, two members of parliament remain behind bars and another is on the run for their role in what the police call acts of criminality and violations of the law during recent violent pro-democracy protests. Tulani Maseko is the lawyer for the two jailed members of parliament and another who is on the run. He says the judge on Tuesday postponed again a bail hearing for the two jailed MPs after the government denied them bail. He says his client feel the government might be manipulating the case to frustrate them.
Yeah, they remain in jail. They are quite upset because they feel that the whole thing was being delayed to frustrate them. So they're quite upset. But they're okay. They're alive, except that they're very upset because they feel that not enough progress is being done to get them out on bail. And they don't understand what they believe that they're innocent and they agree with them.
But there's nothing you can do.
There's nothing we can do. We need to pay by the law and by the rules of court. Today, the judge raised an issue. She was saying that we need to persuade her why we believe she can hear the second bail application. She seems to be thinking that the matter should be heard by the Supreme Court as opposed to coming back to her on a second bail application with new facts that we are raising, which we think is not the right way to do it. So she must decide whether or not there are new threats from the new bail application. And then if she feels there are new threats, then she can hear the bail writer. If she feels there are not new threats, then she can dismiss the application. But she doesn't seem to be following our argument quite well. But that she then reserves the ruling on that issue for Tuesday next week.
Why does she feel that she thinks the case should be heard by the Supreme Court? Why does she feel that way?
So there's a principle in law called functus officio. So she felt that she's now functus officio, having heard the first aid application. And we don't think that's the way it should be approached. A litigant has a right to come to court second time around if there's been some new developments. And that's what our law says. And then if you're not satisfied with the finding on the second bail application, you can then approach the Supreme Court as an appeal. So we think that she just wants to avoid dealing with the bail matter itself so that the matter can then go to the Supreme Court. I think she's, in our view, she wants to avoid deciding the bail question again.
In the meantime, your clients, the two MPs, remain behind bars. How are they feeling?
Yeah, in the meantime, they remain behind bars, quite upset. I think people feel that there's a lot of interference in the manner that this case is being handled. People feel that there might be a lot of things happening behind closed doors to try and undermine and frustrate the rule of law in Swaziland. Maybe there's some credence in that approach. I mean, well, this is just a simple bail application, and the evidence against them, which has been given to us so far, does not link them with the alleged acts of terror that the government is complaining about. So we don't quite understand why they're being denied bail when there's nothing that links them to the offense that alleged have been committed.
In the meantime, there was another MP, I think it's Mr. Similani. What has happened? Is he still on the run?
Yeah, he's still at large, that one. He has not yet submitted for arrest. So the warrant of his arrest is still alive.
Tulani Maseko is the lawyer for two jailed Eswatini members of parliament and another who is on the run. He was speaking with us from the capital, Mbabane. A new national study has found that South Africa's school dropout rate has tripled following disruptions to education brought on by the pandemic. Educators and nonprofits are now racing to intervene and encourage youth to enroll. From Johannesburg, Linda Giftage has more.
Kubelo Ramanwane did not return to his rural high school north of Pretoria when classes reopened after pandemic lockdowns. The 16-year-old got used to spending his days at home. With limited access to technology, online learning was impossible, and he quickly fell behind. Child and youth care workers like Marie Van Rooyen, who provide support to students at his school, say he's among many who felt too discouraged to come back.
It's hard for them to catch up. When I speak to the learners, they tell me that it's overwhelming. So some of them, they feel demotivated to come back to school or to come to school also. They're saying it's too much work because of the pandemic.
A national study on the effects of the pandemic in South Africa found that 500,000 students dropped out of school by May of this year. That's compared to 230,000 dropouts in 2018. Experts say not graduating increases children's likelihood to join gangs, use drugs, be abused, or become pregnant. Rahima Esop is the head of communications and advocacy for South Africa's Zero Dropout campaign.
We know that learners who drop out of school before completing the final year of high school, known as matric here in South Africa, struggle to find decent jobs. Dropout isn't just the problem of the individual or the individual's family or community. Dropout is a problem that affects the country as a whole, as well as the economic health of the country.
The Zero Dropout campaign says just one adult taking interest in a child's education can turn things around. The Izabindi Ezekweleni program is attempting to do that by providing 29 schools with child and youth care workers. Care providers offer students education and social support in the class, at home, and during lockdowns, by phone. The Zero Dropout campaign and its partners are calling on the government to launch a nationwide strategy to re-enroll and retain students. They also want to see better attendance record keeping so schools can track and trace absenteeism to identify at-risk students before they drop out. Linda Giftash for VOA News, Johannesburg.
And that's it for this Wednesday, September 8th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa team, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all our engineers, I'm James Butte in Washington, saying have a lovely day.